I'm Peggy Waymire. On the World Vision Report this week, we continue our series from Gaza, and we visit another of the world's hotspots, North Korea.
They told her that they would help her earn money and that she would work for a computer company. But she ended up locked in this house and is forced to strip for men over the internet.
A missionary network helps North Korean women who have fled across the border to China and end up in the hands of traffickers. Plus, pulque is a mildly alcoholic drink that was popular decades ago in Mexico. Now it's seeing something of a rebirth.
I feel that this drink is worth saving so that it can nourish not only our generation and the ones that come after, but so that it's valued as an ancestral drink and as a handcrafted drink.
And we hear about the life and music of Busi Mushlongo, the South African superstar who died earlier this year. Around the world with the World Vision Report. First, news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. Peace talks between Israel and Palestine are at an impasse again. It's been 40 years since Israel invaded the Palestinian territories, and during that time, many Palestinians have been imprisoned or interrogated by Israel. Former detainees wear that as a badge of honor, proud to have suffered in their fight for an independent state. But there's one thing former Palestinian prisoners don't like to talk about, and that's torture. Torture not only by Israeli security forces, but at the hands of Palestinian interrogators who round up opponents among their own people. Daniel Estrin brings us part two in our series on Gaza.
Our secret meeting is set for nighttime. I sit in the back of the car with my interpreter as our driver snakes through narrow alleyways. We park and make our way into a backyard. The neighbors are playing Arabic dance music. There are a few plastic chairs in a small circle and two men. It's really dark. I squint, I lean forward, but I can't make out the faces of the men sitting right across from me. These two men have been in the darkness for a long time. They've never told anyone but close family and friends what they're about to tell me. Mohammed and Ismail aren't their real names. They won't tell me their real names. And they won't let me record their voices. They're afraid they could be punished for talking. What you are about to hear is the voice of my interpreter. He repeats what the men say in Arabic and translates it into English.
My name is Hamad. This is the first time that I'm talking to a journalist about my experience, how I was tortured in a Hamas prison. Yes, they came to my house at 2 a.m. and they entered and they took me in my way to the prison. They beat me with a heavy wood. I began to blood.
To be blood
before I reached the prison.
The Hamas interrogators accused Mohammed of being an activist with the rival Palestinian party Fatah. To understand this, you have to know that there are two Palestinian territories, Gaza on one side of Israel and the West Bank on the other side of Israel. Gaza is controlled by Hamas and the West Bank is governed by Fatah. Mohammed says once he got to the Hamas detention center, he was abused in different ways. He says the interrogators even put staples in his back. The second man has an equally appalling tale.
My name is Ismail. I was put in the prison by the Hamas government many times, and they shot my legs twice.
Ismail picks up his cell phone and uses it as a flashlight to show me the scar above his ankle, where a bullet went in one side and out the other. Then he describes a kind of mind game he had to play.
They have a wall and they are drawing in the wall a ladder, a bicycle or a cat, different shapes, and sometimes they ask us to climb the ladder or to ride the bicycle and sometimes to take off the teeth of the cat. Of course, you can do that, and after that they will beat you severely in different areas, in your body, in your stomach, in your head. They don't care.
Then there's the damage you can't see on the outside, the fear. Mohammed says interrogators call him in for questioning every few months. The rest of the time, he's afraid they track his every move. Neighbors, friends, people in the street. He doesn't trust anybody. Suddenly, a car pulls up with its headlights pointed towards us. We're all startled. It turns out to be a neighbor, but Ismail fidgets in his seat.
All the time I am afraid, even if anyone informs them that we have a meeting here or we are sitting here, so they will come and they will arrest us in front of your eyes.
Both men say that interrogators have warned them not to speak to human rights advocates. That's why it's hard for Issam Younis to investigate claims of torture. Younis works for the Mizan Center for Human Rights, which represents Palestinian prisoners in Gaza. He says in the last few years, only a small handful have had the courage to tell him what they experienced. What's happening is no secret, he claims. Hamas mistreats detainees in Gaza, where it's in power, and Fatah does the same where it rules, from Ramallah in the West Bank.
And to be honest, we are governed by a tribal mentality. Detaining people in Ramallah could be followed by a reaction from here to arrest people in the Gaza.
Younis lights a cigarette and shrugs.
It's a cycle of torture, if you like.
Hamas spokesman Ihab Gusein actually admitted to me that his men tortured detainees. And he says he can explain why. When Hamas took control of Gaza in 2007, it put its own guys, who were novices, in charge of interrogations.
They don't have any experience. They don't have any training. They didn't work ever in the security agencies. Maybe they don't know how to investigate the people. And they think that, you know, hitting or torturing the people is the correct thing to investigate. And they used it.
Hussein says Hamas rejects torture and that it has brought perpetrators to justice. The human rights worker, Younis, says he hasn't been able to verify that claim. Hamas doesn't give him names or details. But Younis does say that Hamas isn't mistreating detainees as much as it used to. Hamas seems less concerned with seeking revenge and more involved in the nuts and bolts of governing. Still, things are far from ideal.
You know, culturally, it's not easy for the torture survivors to seek or to ask for mental health services.
Psychologist Hassan Ziyada works at the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. He says most victims won't come forward for help because they're afraid of what their neighbors will say. And more than that, they've lost trust in their own community.
It's a very painful experience for any Palestinian person to be tortured by a Palestinian. Some of them cannot imagine and they cannot accept that it happened for them.
In the backyard, the two men whom I meet at night tell me their interrogators warned them not to talk to psychologists or even journalists. A friend persuaded them to talk to me, but they're eager to end our conversation. I ask one more question. Wouldn't it take a load off your shoulders to talk about your experiences, not to keep them bottled up inside? Here's Ismail.
When I talk to you, I'm recalling the bad memories and the hard experience that I passed. I can't forget these bad memories, but I didn't feel good after talking to you.
With that, I was quickly ushered back to the car, leaving Mohammed and Ismail in the dark of the night. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniel Estrin, the Gaza Strip.
It's cold and flu season here in the U.S. If you lived in India, your mother might tell you to eat some amla, or Indian gooseberry, because it's loaded with vitamins. Amla is sold in many different forms as treatment for everything from the common cold to eyesight problems and diabetes. It's even said to fend off gray hair and pimples. But it's also very hard to swallow. From Ahmedabad, India, Jill Ryan has the story of one family who makes a living trying to make the fruit taste better.
An Indian gooseberry, or amla, looks like a glow-in-the-dark golf ball, and when you first taste it, you'll probably want to spit it out.
It is sourest. It is very sour.
39-year-old Ashish Mehta has pulled to the side of a busy road in Ahmedabad to buy amla from a roadside cart.
But we know it is full of vitamin C, and that is the beauty of this fruit.
12-year-old Daksha Chauhan is running her family's amla stand today, though you won't find her sneaking a bite.
I don't eat raw amla. It's too sour.
Still, Daksha's family doesn't just sell the raw fruit, they also juice it, pickle it, and dry it. They even sell the seeds to be crushed into powder, unless the neighborhood goats eat them first. Diksha's younger brother, 10-year-old Ashutosh Chauhan, leads the way to his family's one-room home in the patio where the amla is prepared.
Hello!
Ashutosh's father, Bejubhai Chauhan, learned how to prepare the fruit when he was just a boy. His family's been selling it for generations. Today, he and his wife are cooking the amla, which helps remove some of the bitterness. First, they drop the fruit into a pot of boiling water. Then Bejubhai adds a mixture of citric acid and salt. Bejubhai's wife, Paruben Chauhan, takes over. She blows on the fire to keep it going and keep the amla cooking. After boiling the fruit for a little over 5 minutes, Paruben reaches a long slotted spoon into the bubbling pot and scoops out each amla and drops them into a basket. When all the fruit has cooled, she hands the basket to her son and the neighborhood boys. They scamper up an iron gate next to the house and spread the amla on a tarp on the metal roof.
Yeah.
For the next few days, the fruit will dry in the sun. Meanwhile, the family begins another task, making juice from amla. First, they shred it into fine strands.
We take a cloth and we put all the grated stuff inside. Then we twist it and the juice comes out.
Paruben pours the murky greenish liquid into old used water bottles the family collects. She says her customers just take one or two spoonfuls a day, like a medicine, or they dilute it with water because most people find it too sour to drink straight. The Chauhan family will continue to juice and dry the amla until the season is over. Paruben says it's hard work. Her husband chimes in.
We can't get ahead in life with this. My father, my grandfather, their lives were spent doing this. They really couldn't do anything more in their life.
Paruben and Bejubhai hope to be able to afford to send their son to college so he can have an easier life, which means they have a lot of gooseberry selling in front of them. But despite the long days preparing the amla, some of the family's happiest memories are connected with the fruit.
Do you, like, remember the first time that you ever tasted amla?
Yes, when I got married and came here, that's the first time I tasted amla. I like it. The juice was really nice. It had a sourness that I liked.
For the World Vision Report, I'm Jill Ryan in Ahmedabad, India.
Up, women who flee from North Korea often end up in the hands of human traffickers. We speak to somebody who helps them escape. Stay with us. Peggy Waymire, welcome back to the World Vision Report. North Korea's attack on a South Korean island last week catapulted the region into a crisis. Things only got worse when North Korea released a report saying it's advancing its nuclear program. Some observers believe these provocations are a roundabout way of distracting attention from serious problems inside the country. There's a succession crisis, the country is desperately poor, and the people live under harsh and repressive conditions. Many are risking their lives to flee across the border into China in search of food or jobs. But that's especially precarious for North Korean women. Many of them fall into the hands of human traffickers. It's estimated that tens of thousands of North Korean women are being held in China against their will. Jason Strother reports from Seoul, South Korea.
Chun Ki-won wastes no time when he arrives at his office in Seoul. He logs onto an internet chat program and turns on his webcam. He's trying to get in contact with Seung-hee, a 20-year-old girl he met a few months ago online. Chun selects her name from his list of contacts, and the messenger program starts ringing.
Sorry,
a pretty young woman appears on Chun's screen. She's wearing a striped black and white tank top. She has big eyes and long dark hair. As they begin to talk, it's clear this is no ordinary webcam chat. Chun is pastor of the Dorihana Church in Seoul, and Seung-hee is a North Korean refugee who is being held inside a house in northeast China. Chun is trying to help her escape and come to South Korea. He says Seung-hee became the victim of human traffickers after she left North Korea a year ago.
When she was on the border with China, some Chinese men of Korean descent bribed the border guard to sneak her across. They told her that they would help her earn money and that she would work for a computer company. But she ended up locked in this house and is forced to strip for men over the internet.
Seung-hee's story is typical of North Korean women who cross into China, according to human rights groups. Many are picked up by traffickers. Some are sold as wives to Chinese men. Others are put to work in the sex trade. And because China routinely arrests and deports North Koreans who've entered the country illegally, the women don't seek help from the police. Pastor Chun says this makes it more difficult to reach those in need.
Years ago in China, it was easy to meet North Korean women anywhere on the streets. But these days, it's too dangerous for them to go out. Also, much of the prostitution they're forced into is done online.
Still, Chun says his church has brought 900 North Koreans to South Korea over the past 11 years. It's done with the help of missionaries working secretly in China, including some from the Dorihana Church. The missionaries run a network of safe houses where they hide North Koreans until they're able to sneak them into countries in Southeast Asia where it's easier to seek asylum. One defector Chun helped escape from China is a 30-year-old woman who asked to be called Hana. Like many North Koreans, she crossed the border multiple times. Hana says after one escape in 2004, a Chinese man promised her a safe place to stay. But Hana says she was treated like his prisoner.
That man was quite older than me, and at first I depended on him because I thought he would take care of me. But after a time, he became violent. Whenever I tried to leave his home, he beat me. I became very scared of him.
I ask Hana if that man also forced her to have sex with him. She nods her head. Hana did eventually leave, but instead of finding freedom, she was forcibly repatriated by Chinese authorities. In North Korea, escapees are considered criminals. When she was handed over, Hana was sent to a North Korean prison camp.
I was kept in a small room at the prison with some North Korean officers. I had to kneel in front of them. They kicked me in the stomach, and one beat me with his belt. They called me a prostitute. It was then that I knew I had to escape again, that I couldn't live in North Korea anymore.
She made it to South Korea with the help of the undercover missionaries. Hana now lives at the Dorihana Church with several other North Korean women. She's also attending university. She hopes to one day become a missionary herself. Pastor Chun says Hana was lucky to get out of North Korea alive. Some women never make it. Others are seriously harmed.
A pregnant woman will be forced to have an abortion. Prison officials will hit her and give her drugs to cause her to abort. I once helped a woman who had been 6 months pregnant when she was sent back to North Korea. Her baby was killed, and she became very sick from an infection caused by the abortion.
Chun says for these reasons, he must keep working to get as many North Korean women as possible into South Korea. But he says it can be frustrating. Chun continues chatting with Seung-hee, the trafficked North Korean girl who is forced to strip for an online porn site. Chun types to her that he can bring her to South Korea in the next 10 days. But Seung-hee replies she's not ready to go yet. She wants to wait for the money she's been promised by the traffickers for her work. Chun says she just doesn't understand that women in her situation never actually get paid.
She's been asking for my help for months. I don't want to push her, but one of my missionaries will go to that area soon.
But ultimately, it's up to Seung-hee to decide whether to go with them, and that may not be an easy decision for her. Chun says many of these women no longer trust anyone, even those who want to help them. For the World Vision Report, I'm Jason Strother in Seoul.
It's estimated that up to 80% of North Korean women refugees end up being trafficked in some way. As you just heard in Jason's story, some are purchased by Chinese men to be wives or concubines. Others are forced to work as prostitutes. But the story doesn't end there. Many of these women end up getting pregnant and having babies. If the women are arrested and sent back to North Korea, as many of them are, they're forced to leave their children behind in China. Tim Peters is a Christian pastor from Michigan who runs a charity based in Seoul called Helping Hands Korea. He's actively involved in rescuing these abandoned children.
When we come in contact with these children, the mother has already been caught by the Chinese police and forcibly repatriated to North Korea without the child. It is an absolute trampling on every conceivable human right that anyone would have by the forcible separation of mothers and children and the sending of those women back.
Why would they possibly make the mothers go back without their children?
The birth father is almost invariably Chinese. Therefore, the Chinese authorities do not send the children back with the mothers. And the problem with that, of course, is that when these Chinese men who purchase, in most cases, the North Korean refugee woman, when the woman is gone, in many cases, these men, some are unwilling and some are unable to really care for the kids.
How many children are we talking about? Can you estimate how many babies have been born to these women and then left by their moms?
Some organizations, and you have to brace yourself for this, have estimated that the numbers of these children are as high as 50 to 100,000 throughout China at this time.
We're talking tens of thousands of children who are left
Yes.
behind. Are they North Korean citizens or are they Chinese citizens?
That's just it. They're stateless children. They're completely in limbo. The mothers, of course, have never been documented, so that means that the relationship with the birth father is not documented. So the children themselves are not documented. They're stateless children, which means that they do not have access to education in this situation, nor do they have access to medical care specifically.
The abandoned children range from babies to young teenagers. Many of the men who fathered them want nothing to do with them. In some cases, the extended family might take a child in, but too often, there's nobody looking after these kids. Tim Peters and others like him are doing what they can.
There's one case of a little 11-year-old boy who was taking shelter in an abandoned house in a farm village, and he was trying to eat garbage out of the dump and got food poisoning. I mean, miraculously, a local evangelist in the area found the boy and took him under his wing. But because China has not done anything to meaningfully deal with the refugee problem over the last 15 years, the problem is only getting worse by the month, and therefore there is an enormous number of these situations where mothers and children have been separated.
Now, does your group have the resources to take these children to South Korea?
Well, we have to remember that these children, because they're undocumented, cannot be taken to a South Korean embassy, for example. And so
they're just stuck. So these kids are basically stuck.
They're stuck. So we have to try to do what we can do to try to care for their needs in China.
How many people are there in an organization like yours who can actually do this? Because it seems like a drop in the bucket. If we're saying there are an estimated 50,000 children, a lot of kids must be falling through the cracks.
Absolutely. They are falling through the cracks. And I wish I could say that our organization has been replicated by hundreds of other organizations, but this is not a popular type of humanitarian work.
Why? I mean, what could be more popular than helping abandoned children on the border of North Korea and China?
It should be, but this is not a major area of focus. This is still not considered a major area of concentration, and that's a great worry to me.
What's it going to take?
Well, I think it's going to take a miracle, because frankly, it is a tragedy of immense proportions, and we need to take care of these children because it is a disgrace that more is not being done to help them.
Tim Peters runs the Seoul-based charity called Helping Hands Korea. Tim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
World AIDS Day on December 1st was a great opportunity to reflect on how much progress has been made in dealing with this disease. We'll take stock right now in this week's Globe at a Glance. It's hard to find good things to say about a disease that's killed 30 million people over the last 30 years, but there have been some real breakthroughs this year. The first one is a vaginal gel that a woman can use to prevent being infected with HIV. That's important in countries where women don't often have the power to refuse sex with infected partners. The study out of South Africa showed a 40% reduction in infection among women who used the gel. And just last week, government researchers announced that men who were at high risk of getting HIV could take a pill to prevent infection. The study involved 2,500 men in six countries. Results showed that men who took the pill had 44% fewer infections than those who didn't. This is big news because it's the first time it's been shown that a pill can be used to prevent infection. The ultimate goal, a vaccine against HIV/AIDS, remains elusive for now. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Cancun is a favorite tourist destination. Visitors go there for the beautiful beaches and the nightlife. This week, the city is filled with a slightly different crowd. Scientists, politicians, activists, and journalists from all over the world are attending the UN Climate Change Conference in Cancun. But if conference attendees step outside the halls and hotels for a moment, they're likely to hear this. It's a song called Bésame, sung by Mexican rock group Camila. It's topped the charts on radio stations all over Mexico this week. Visitors to Cancun don't only get to hear local music, they also get to taste some local refreshments. Tequila is a favorite made from the agave plant. But there's another drink made from agave, and it might be better for you. It's called pulque. It's a mildly alcoholic beverage, and it's been consumed in Mexico for thousands of years. The drink has fallen out of fashion in modern Mexico, but that might be changing, as Shannon Young reports.
At the dawn of the 20th century, pulque bars, known as pulquerias, were everywhere in Mexico City. Now, only a few dozen remain. Pulque has a fresh, slightly acidic flavor and a thick consistency. It's either served plain or blended with fruits or vegetables, like a smoothie. Pulque fell out of favor due to a combination of the rise in beer consumption, unfounded rumors about bad production hygiene, and its stigmatization as a drink for the poor. 75-year-old Leopoldo López García is the owner of La Antigua Roma, a pulqueria which has been in business for over a century. López witnessed pulque's heyday in his childhood, and then its slow and steady decline.
It's a real shame, and not because I have a stake in the matter, that an authentic national product like this is disappearing. And the saddest part is how they've disparaged it. It's sad, and that's what hurts us the most. Meanwhile, wine, beer, and other types of drinks are flying sky high. There are very few pulquerias nowadays, even though I believe it's a product that's really less harmful than the others.
The effect of pulque on human health is a topic of interest to Luis Raúl Tovar, a nutrition researcher at Mexico's National Polytechnic Institute.
We are trying to revive, based on scientific facts, a drink that seems to be pretty good.
Tovar and his fellow researchers found that pulque contains a digestive enzyme called phytase, which helps to unlock nutrients found in several foods, among them corn.
And one of the main staples of this country is corn. What drinking pulque does is that having this phytase activity, then, and having your tortillas and chili and beans and so forth, you make much more available iron, zinc, calcium, and magnesium.
Like wine, another alcoholic beverage with health benefits, pulque works best when consumed in moderation. I asked Tovar if people could survive on a diet of corn, beans, chili peppers, basically the Mexican subsistence diet, if it's combined with pulque.
I'm not sure about that, to tell you the truth. It'd be nice if you can eat other things too, you know. But if there is a crisis, it'll be good to have pulque again in the country.
Back in La Antigua Roma, pulque fan Felipe Ramirez tells how the drink helped his family through a crisis in the late 1920s.
My grandfather talks about how he clearly remembers a severe drought in his early childhood. During the shortage of food and water, their diet was based on pulque, caterpillars, and small wild fruits. My grandfather credits pulque with his survival.
While it is possible to get drunk with pulque, it requires relatively large amounts of the filling beverage. Ramirez runs a blog about the remaining pulquerias in Greater Mexico City. It's some of the only publicity that pulque has received in a long time.
I feel that this drink is worth saving so that it can nourish not only our generation and the ones that come after, but so that it's valued as an ancestral drink and as a handcrafted drink, as something that's worth knowing how it's made and why it's still made. It's worth saving so that other people can enjoy what we are enjoying right now.
The publicity seems to be having an impact, says owner Leopoldo López García, who has run La Antigua Roma for 45 years.
It's changed in relation to the clientele. Young people never used to come before. Now, they're the main customers, you know, 20 to 25-year-olds.
But something tells me these 20-somethings may not be drinking pulque precisely for its health benefits. For the World Vision Report, I'm Shannon Young in Mexico City.
If you want to find out how to make pulque, there's a slideshow on our website, worldvisionreport.org. And coming up next, the queen of South African Maskanda music. Stay tuned. This is the World Vision Report, and that's the sound of Busi Mahlangu. The South African superstar started out performing covers in the 60s, but over time she developed a distinctive and powerful voice of her own. Earlier this year, Busi died from a long battle with breast cancer. She left behind a lifetime of music and many adoring fans. The World Vision Report's Lita Hartman spoke to one of Busi's fans, our global music guy, Ish Mafundukwa.
So Ish, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, it's great to be back, Lita.
So we have been listening to South Africa singer Busi Mahlangu. She died recently. Could you tell us a little bit about her?
In the very beginning, Busi went by her middle name, which was Victoria. She was called Busi Victoria Mahlangu. And I used to listen to her on the radio. I remember she did a cover of the Beatles' Can't Buy Me Love. And also My Boy Lollipop by Millie. Those are the two songs that I remember her doing, and then suddenly she was gone. I don't know where she'd gone to.
What do you mean she was gone?
I got to know later that that disappearance was about her leaving South Africa, because like a lot of black people during the apartheid period, those who could leave actually did go, and she ended up in Portugal.
She ended up in Portugal. Did she keep up with her music there?
Oh yeah, she did a lot of cabaret appearances in Portugal, and when she got there, she also realized that it's okay to sing in their own languages because I think being over there, people were curious.
It almost took outsiders to make her realize that, it sounds like.
Absolutely. African culture during the colonial period was really marginalized. You know, to be with it or to be hip, you needed to to sing those English songs. I know a lot of musicians, a lot of African musicians who did covers of other people. What it was is colonialism made you feel like you were lesser human beings. And I don't know, maybe to a certain extent, maybe some of us started believing it.
So going to Europe was something of a turning point for her, it sounds like. She met other African musicians. These European listeners appreciated what they heard, her African roots music, that kind of thing. It sounds like it really made a difference in shaping her career.
It was a major turning point because it's also like you mentioned, she got to know people from other parts of Africa, other African musicians, and really just started opening up or widening her horizons and musically and as a human being as well. So it was while she was there that she really came into her own.
Did you see her perform in Europe?
Actually, I did. It was, I think, around 1990. This journalist friend of mine, a Dutch guy, he was like, man, you should see this woman. She's amazing. So we went off to see her together, and it was sublime. And then a couple of weeks later, he came to me and showed me the sleeve notes that he was writing for her first album, which was released in 1991, an album called Babemu. And then I saw her full names, and then the penny dropped. I was like, what? Victoria? This is Vicky Mhlongo.
Huh. And did you ever get a chance to talk with her while she was playing around Europe and you were on the music scene yourself?
Yeah, I actually did. Once I got to know she was Vicky, I went to a festival where she was playing, and I went backstage, and instead of saying, hello, Busi, I said, hello, Vicky. And she was like, how do you know that?
And what did she say? What was her reaction?
Then I explained to her that, you know, I listened to her as a kid. I listened to her doing My Boy Lollipop and Money Can't Buy Me Love. And she was like, wow, you know, that's, you got a great memory. And I said, well, because I liked it as I was growing up.
It sounds like she was sort of living in two worlds. There was the South African system of apartheid that she was escaping, and then this much wider open new world in Europe. Did she go back at some point?
Yeah, she did go back in the 80s. And, you know, that was a very difficult time in the history of South Africa when there was, the rejection of apartheid had really, you know, taken root, and people were really, like, angry, and they didn't want any more of it. And there was a lot of violence then. She just could not deal with it. So she left again.
So was this reflected in her music at all? Is there a song that describes this time?
Oh, yes. There's a song from that first album that she did back in 91 called Umenthisi, which is Matches. And she was just talking about the burning and the violence, the mayhem that was happening in South Africa at that time.
Let's listen to some of that. So did Busi go back to South Africa for good?
Yeah, after Mandela got released, she did go back home, like a lot of people went back after Mandela's release, and also after the 1994 elections, which brought about a democratic South Africa.
Tell me what happened to her music once she did go back to South Africa for good. How did it continue to develop?
Yeah, it continued to develop in the sense that, you know, she says she went to a concert, a Maskanda concert. Maskanda is a Zulu sort of traditional slash modern music. She said she was just blown away, and she wanted to record that kind of music as well. She wanted to make Maskanda music, and she did so with an album called Urban Zulu, which was a huge hit.
Okay, let's listen to something from Urban Zulu. What are we going to hear?
One of the hits from that album is called Yapeli Maliami, which is My Money is Finished, It's Gone.
Pele pe pala
Now, Ish, you mentioned that this album, Urban Zulu, has a style of music in it, a South African style called Maskanda. Can you describe that for us? What are we listening for when we're hearing Maskanda?
Maskanda is like maybe the equivalent of the blues for the Zulu people. You know, it's like music played by mostly by men. So, you know, actually when Busi wanted to record Urban Zulu, she went to one of the leading male Maskanda musicians and said, hey, you know, I want to do this. Is it okay for me to do so? And the guy said, sure, and actually gave her musicians to work with.
So she was a bit of a pioneer.
Yeah.
So Ish, did you see Busi again when she had come into her own? She had pioneered this style of a woman playing Maskanda music, all of that. Did you catch up with her after that?
Yeah, I did see her last year in Swaziland at a music festival. And I got an opportunity to chat with her again. Unfortunately, then she was undergoing treatment for this breast cancer.
So despite being sick and undergoing treatment for cancer and so on, she carried on singing, which is really courageous, it sounds like.
Yeah, she certainly did. And seeing her on stage, you wouldn't think there was anything wrong with her because she was just the same energetic Busi that I'd seen like 20 years before. But it showed when I went backstage to talk to her. She was really, really looking tired.
It seems like she was fairly public about having cancer, and she communicated to her audience about that, about making the link between cancer and AIDS. What do you remember about that at the concert that you saw her at?
Yeah, at some point during her concert, she just started talking about this whole stigmatization thing. There's nothing wrong with people with AIDS. She said, you know, like, it's just like me. I've got cancer, but as you can see, I'm okay. So it's the same with people who have AIDS. It's just a condition like I have. You don't have to look down upon people with AIDS.
Would you say that Busi's own individual life story reflects the larger story about Africa coming into its own culturally? I mean, here she started out with the name of the English queen, right? Victoria.
Of all queens.
Right, of all queens. Uh-huh. And then she forged this very original, authentic African sound and presence. Would you say she influenced others to return to their African roots?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, a very good example when it comes to names is Nelson Mandela himself. Nelson is not his given name. That's the name they gave to him at school because you needed a Christian name. So they named him Nelson after the Lord Nelson. But like you rightly say, what happened here is also reflected in a lot of young people today wanting to know their roots and delving into their past in terms of their musical identity, into their own identity. And what Busi did is she really sort of urbanized Maskanda music. And a lot of young musicians today are actually sampling Maskanda music or using Maskanda musicians on their so-called urban music.
So, in other words, she sort of made it hip to call upon tradition.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, she really did. She really did. She played a major role in that respect.
So, Ish, what are we going to go out on?
Yeah, we will go out with this song from Urban Zulu, which once again talks about Busi's love for Africa and its people. And it's a song called Yehliswa Moya Ma Africa, which means Africans be calm.
Notenda Shamwari, thank you very much, my friend.
Munotende. Washona for the bed, Sabula Lana sod. Washona for the bed, Sibula Lana sod. Washona for the bed, Sabula Lana sod.
Haiti is one of the poorest countries in the world, and it's been racked with political turmoil. Even the recent elections were marred by allegations of fraud. But there's still one thing Haitians are proud of, and that's their art. Unfortunately, thousands of pieces of Haitian art were lost in the earthquake almost a year ago. Now there's a move to help Haitian artists start over. Amanda Thiroff reports.
At an art gallery on the west side of Manhattan, people mill about, cocktails in hand, admiring brightly colored paintings.
I love this one right here, the hibiscus and the dove or pigeon. It looks like a dove.
It is a dove.
I know, it's just gorgeous. We love Haitian art.
Tonight's show is a fundraiser called A Taste of Haiti, curated by the Caribbean American Network. It features Haitian music, Haitian hors d'oeuvres, and the work of Haitian artists. Organizer Maud St. Preux says that all the proceeds go to the people of Haiti.
We bring toys for children, we bring water, we bring food. But this time, it's for the artists, because they deserve it. We're going to go to Haiti with paint, with washes, and we're going to have a celebration for them.
St. Preux says that many Haitian artists not only lost their homes in the earthquake, they also lost their artwork, their supplies, maybe even their partner who was supporting them. They lost their livelihoods.
If people can purchase their art, they won't starve. They will find money to eat. And this is the goal and the dream.
10 months after the Haitian earthquake, much of the destruction remains. Most people live in tents. Many still struggle to find food and water. But even so, artists are everywhere. Driving through Port-au-Prince, I see sidewalks packed with artists selling ironwork and hand-carved furniture. One man approaches cars with his paintings, peddling them like another man peddles oranges or bags of water. In a gallery in Port-au-Prince, I meet up with a wood artist named John Lefehi L'Espérance, a small, soft-spoken man in a Panama hat. One of his pieces, a 4-foot-tall, hand-carved wooden urn, is featured in St. Preux's show in New York.
This is all I do. This is what I do for my living. It's hard for me. The shop I used to work in collapsed. The house I used to live in collapsed. My family is living in a tent.
L'Espérance survives hand-to-mouth, selling his work piece by piece to get by. He says his dream is to build up a collection and have an exhibit where he lives in Haiti, but he can't afford to. Other wood artists in Port-au-Prince end up on the side of the road carving furniture, chairs and tables and armoires, even as 1.5 million Haitians are homeless. Before the quake, the Gallery Nader in Port-au-Prince housed the largest privately owned collection of Haitian art in the country, 15,000 paintings. Now, the 3-story gallery is gone. Standing amidst the rubble, gallery director Georges Nader says he recovered a lot of the artwork, but it was in bad shape.
We start digging, and as we dig, we start getting painting out. We got out of 15,000 paintings, we got about 12,000 of them out of the rubbles.
We climb on top of the broken concrete, and there are bits of painting still trapped between the stones. Bright blue skies, palm trees.
So do you recognize all the pieces, or you had so many, you know?
Yeah, I mean, just by looking at this, I can see that that's Dubik. That's Abner Dubik. I mean, there is no way that you can save that. This is probably
it's
a pendant.
Kind of all scrunched.
Yeah, this is worth about $600, so I mean, that's about 10% of the piece, so there's nothing you can do about it.
No one's buying art within the country anyway, Nader says. They have other things to worry about, like rebuilding their homes. So most of the interest comes from outside the country.
This is quality stuff.
Back in New York, Washington, D.C. businessman Alfred Toussaint admires L'Espérance's work.
I mean, the workmanship is unbelievable. I mean, you know, it's methodical, it's meticulous. What more not to love?
But he's not buying tonight.
I don't know how I would be able to carry this on the plane with me tomorrow.
Art is a hard sell, even in New York City. Fundraisers like A Taste of Haiti are helping connect Haitian artists with buyers and get them the supplies they need to continue working. But they also present a different image of Haiti. Not poverty and destruction, but full of vibrant color. I asked George Nader why people should donate to artists when so many Haitians are struggling to find food and water. He laughed like I'd asked the stupidest question in the world. You can't let a culture die, he said. For the World Vision Report, I'm Amanda Thiroff.
And that brings us to the end of our show this week. Just a quick reminder that you can find us on the web at worldvisionreport.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. The show is produced by Beverly Abel. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is the engineering assistant. Chris Baldiga is the production assistant. I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the organization.